Finally, the grandson of the crucified Khosrew II, Yazdegerd III, a curly-haired man with joined eyebrows and fine teeth, Al-Tabari writes, had managed to take the throne by appealing to none other than Heraclius for help. He had been king over the remains of Persia for only a year when Khalid and his Arab armies appeared on the other side of the Euphrates. At the same time, other Arab troops were making their way towards the Byzantine provinces of Palestine and Syria, under the command of four other generals. The Byzantine troops put up a stronger resistance than Abu Bakr had expected, and just as Khalid was getting ready to attack the Persians, Abu Bakr recalled him and sent him westward to help out on the Palestinian front. Yazdegerd III had gotten a very brief reprieve, but at the expense of Heraclius. Byzantium, like Persia, had suffered from the long war. Its soldiers were tired and depleted. The combined Arab troops defeated them in two large battles, capturing Damascus and moving through Palestine into Syria. Just as the conquests were gathering momentum, Abu Bakr died. He had been caliph for 2 years and was an elderly 61. He had been careful to leave strict instructions as to the succession. He wanted his son-in-law, Umar, to inherit his power, and the transition occurred in Mecca without chaos. On the battlefront, the armies pressed forward without halting. Umar knew that his first task was to keep fighting. Al-Tabari tells us that when he was first acclaimed, he was addressed as Caliph of the Messenger of God. "Too long-winded," Umar said. "When another caliph comes along, what will you call him? Caliph of the Caliph of the Caliph of the Messenger of God? You are the faithful, and I am your commander." It was a moment of transition. As commander of the faithful, Umar was no longer merely Muhammad's successor. He was the commander-in-chief of a new and expanding empire. At this point, Heraclius realized that he had misjudged his enemy. This was not a bothersome raid. It was a serious and terrifying challenge to his power. To meet it, he put together a great coalition force. His own men, Armenian soldiers, Slavs from up north of the Black Sea, Ghassanid Arabs, and anyone else he could find. In this way, he managed to field an army of 150,000. His coalition met the invading Arabic forces at the Yarmouk River in Syria. Fighting went on for 6 entire days. The narratives of the battle are confused and contradictory, but they all end in the same way. The Byzantine army was routed, and Heraclius was forced to give up the provinces of Syria and Palestine, which he had just gotten back from the Persians. Jerusalem held out until the end of 637. Heraclius's only victory was in managing to get the fragment of the true cross out of the city and back to Constantinople before Jerusalem was forced to surrender to occupying Arab forces. Meanwhile, Khalid turned back eastward and marched against Persia. He stormed all the way to Ctesiphon, which surrendered in the same year as Jerusalem. Yazdegerd survived the conquest of the capital and fled eastward, still alive, but without his capital city. The conquests continued. In 639, Arab armies invaded the Byzantine holdings in Egypt, and by 640, all of Heraclius's Egyptian land, except for the city of Alexandria, was under Arab rule. Heraclius himself was in increasingly poor health. He had brought the empire back from the brink of destruction, only to see it fall away again in the face of an unexpected and unstoppable eruption of force from the south. He was unable to put together a counteroffensive, and in 641 he had a stroke and died. This left Constantinople in a bad position at a dreadful time. Heraclius had left the rule of the city to his son Constantine III, who was in perpetually poor health. He suffered from epileptic seizures. As insurance against Constantine III's sudden death, he had also made his younger son co-emperor. This younger son, Heraclonus, was Constantine III's half-brother, child of Heraclius's second marriage to his own niece, Martina. This marriage had been very unpopular in Constantinople, which widely regarded it as a breach of biblical law. When Constantine III died a few months after his coronation, just as his father had feared, Heraclonus became sole emperor, and because he was only 15, his mother Martina became his regent. The army revolted under the leadership of the general Valentinus and took Heraclonus and Martina captive. Both were ritually mutilated before being sent into exile. Heraclonus's nose was slit and Martina's tongue cut out. Mutilating a claimant to royal power was a ritual method of making him ineligible for rule. It had never been carried out in Constantinople before, and it wasn't exactly foolproof. Heraclonus was perfectly capable of ruling with a slit nose, but it seems to have played on the Old Testament regulation which stipulated that deformed priests could not minister in the temple. The sudden appearance of ritual mutilation in Constantinople suggests that the emperor had become much, much more than a king. He was also some sort of guarantor of God's favour, the channel of God's grace. The people of Constantinople saw Heraclius's incestuous marriage as a sin that was bringing judgment on them. As the unknown religion spread towards them from the south, they were desperate for a king who would bring salvation. The options were limited, and the Senate chose Constans II, son of the dead epileptic Constantine III. He was only 11, and on his accession, he read to the Senate a statement that concluded, "I invite you to assist me by your advice and judgment in providing for the general safety of my subjects." The words had undoubtedly been provided for him. The Senate wanted Constans as the symbol of God's continuing presence in the palace at Constantinople, but they intended to keep power for themselves. Neither the symbol nor the power seemed to work. The empire continued to shrink both to the west and to the east. In 642, the year after Constans II was crowned, the Lombard king Rothari carried out a quick and savage conquest of the remaining Byzantine lands in Italy, leaving only the Ravenna marshes under the control of Constantinople. Of the few Byzantine troops left in Italy, 8,000 died in the fighting and the rest fled. At the same time, Alexandria fell to the Arabs. Egypt was completely gone. Hispania had disappeared years ago. Italy was almost out of reach. North Africa was cut off from the rest of the empire. Only Asia Minor and the land around Constantinople itself remained in Byzantine hands. The new caliph of the Arabs, Umar, had his eye on even wider conquests. He sent an army through the conquered lands of Persia, far to the east, all the way to the Makran, the bare land that lay past the far eastern Persian border. Almost 1,000 years earlier, the Makran had killed off 3/4 of Alexander the Great's army as they marched home from India. Apart from straggling settlements along the coast of the Arabian Sea, where the sparse population subsisted on fish, there was no food or water in the Makran, just trackless sand and rock. But the desert that had almost destroyed Alexander's legendary army was familiar to the Arabs. They knew how to survive in the dry sands, and they pressed on through the Makran until, as Al-Tabari tells us, they reached the river. They had come to the Indus, the edge of India itself. Chapter 40. Intersection. Between 640 and 684, the Arabs turn back from the north of India, and the fractured south draws together. At the Indus, the Arab armies found a gathered Indian army waiting for them. The Makran army and the king Rasil had assembled on the banks of the river, says Al-Tabari, apparently in an effort to keep the Arabs from attempting to cross the water, and the ruler of Sindh had crossed over to join with him. These were local Hindu kingdoms, independent of the huge realm ruled by Harsha a little farther to the east. The kingdom in the Makran and the kingdom in the Sindh had remained free from Harsha's grasp, as had the kingdom of the Shahi, farther up to the north. The Shahi was a Buddhist kingdom that had existed in the northern mountains for 100 years. It was in control of the Khyber Pass. Its capital city was Kabul. They had adopted the Persian title King of Kings, Shahi-in Shahi, from their great neighbours, but Persian rule had never stretched all the way to the Indus. The Arabs had already come farther east than any army since Alexander's. The Shahi, not yet threatened by conquest, did not come south to assist the kings from the Makran and the Sindh, and the combined army was defeated. The Arabs pursued them back to the Indus River and drove them across it. Then, before crossing, the commander Al-Hakam camped in the Makran and sent a messenger back to the Caliph Umar, bearing a fifth of the spoils from the battle and asking what to do next. According to Al-Tabari, when the messenger arrived, Umar asked what kind of land the Makran was. He got a less than enthusiastic report. "It is a land whose plains are mountains," the messenger told him, "whose only fruit is poor quality dates, whose enemies are heroes, whose prosperity is little, whose evil is long-lasting. What is much there is little. What is little there is nothing. As for what lies beyond, it is even worse." Umar decided that neither the Makran nor the Sindh were worth expending any more energy on. He wrote back to Al-Hakam, forbidding him to pass over the river. the Arab armies turned back, and the eastern border of the growing Islamic realm remained, for the time being, in the Makran. In frustration, Al-Hakam composed a verse in his own defence. "The army can place no blame on what I did, nor can my sword be blamed. Were it not for my commander's veto, we would have passed over." Had Umar known that another great empire existed farther to the east, perhaps the Arabs would have pressed on. Harsha's northern Indian kingdom was, by this time, richer and more powerful than the Persians. His defeat by the Chalukya, some years earlier, had halted his southern expansion at the Narmada River, but he had continued his wars of conquest until the entire north and northeast were under his control. Probably the king of the Sindh and the ruler of the Shahi were his tributaries, at least for a time. The two independent kingdoms lay as a useful buffer between his realm and invasion from the west. Now in his late 30s, Harsha had reached his full strength and maturity. His capital, Kannauj, had grown into the premier city of northern India. He sent at least one diplomat to establish friendly relations with the Chinese court to his east. His taxes, reports the Chinese pilgrim Xuan Zang, were reasonable, and if he forced his people to work on roads or canals, he paid them for their time. This particularly struck Xuan Zang, who had grown up during the last years of the Sui and had seen the brutal completion of the Grand Canal. Harsha's sister still reigned beside him, and it is probably no coincidence that, at this time, a particular form of Hinduism that highlighted female power, or Shakti, became more prominent. The worshippers who pursued this stream of Hinduism, which was one among many, were called Shaivas, followers of the god Shiva, and of his consort, the goddess. For them, wisdom flowed from Shiva through the goddess, and then from the goddess to the human world. Harsha himself wrote a play, Nagananda, in which Shiva's goddess consort takes a leading role, resurrecting the dead son and heir of a grief-struck king to life and bestowing him with royal powers. In his youth, he had rescued his sister from a funeral pyre. In the play, the goddess lifts the dead young man from a funeral pyre and restores him to life. Yet Harsha also honored Buddhism. In 644, the year after the Arab army turned back from the Indus, he held an enormous assembly in the capital city, so that thousands would have the opportunity to hear Xuan Zang's teaching. He had been much impressed by the monk, and brought together, according to contemporary accounts, 4,000 Indian monks to hear him. Towards the end of his life, he turned more and more towards Mahayana Buddhism, and channeled more of the royal funds towards Buddhist monasteries. After a lifetime of war, he decreed that no living thing should be killed in his domain, and that no one could eat meat for food. Harsha died in 647. It is not clear that he ever married. Certainly he left no sons. His prime minister seized the throne but held it only for a matter of weeks. His empire fell back apart into minor battling kingdoms, and over the next decades, the historical records disintegrate back into chaos. He was the last Indian king who would be able to build an empire in the north. The next ruler to dominate northern India would come from the outside. Meanwhile, the Chalukya domain to the south had fallen on hard times. Pulakesi II's death in 642 had started a 13-year civil war between his sons, which weakened the kingdom and allowed the Pallava enemy to invade. Pulakesi had driven the Pallava out of the northern part of their homeland, the Vengi, and had claimed it for himself. By the time his third son, Vikramaditya, managed to triumph over his brothers and claim the throne in 655, the Pallava armies had taken Vengi back. Vikramaditya had the throne, but he had lost his father's conquests. He had also lost the eastern part of the kingdom. Pulakesi had handed it over to his brother, Vikramaditya's uncle, to govern as his viceroy. When Pulakesi died, the viceroy proclaimed himself king over the eastern territories. The Chalukyas had divided. From now on, the western Chalukya king would govern at Tvatapi, while the eastern Chalukya king would reign over the coastal area. At the same time, a shrunken ancient kingdom in the far southwest was experiencing a revival. The Pandya dynasty had ruled the coast of the south in distant times. The Greek and Roman geographers had known of them, vaguely, as traders and fishermen. Their power had dwindled, although the clan itself had survived. But in the last decades, the Pandya had again begun to establish themselves, first as governors of the city of Madurai, then as rulers of the surrounding countryside. An account from a century later tells us that Madurai at this time was the headquarters of the Sangam, an academy where poets and their patrons gathered to write and read. Poems and epics written in Tamil, the language of the South Indians, were joined by a translation of the Mahabharata into Tamil. The academy met at Madurai for a century and a half, from around 600 until 750. Vikramaditya of the Western Chalukya attacked the Pallava again in 670, 15 years after coming to the throne. The Pandya, who had been forced to pay tribute to the Pallava king, were now drafted into the conflict as reluctant Pallava allies. Despite the reinforcements, the Chalukya army inflicted a painful defeat on the Pallava king, Parameswaravarman I. The rivalry continued. 4 years later, the Pallava king retaliated by invading and sparking another giant confrontation. This time the fortunes were reversed. The Chalukya soldiers were defeated and driven back. The Western Chalukya king, Vikramaditya, died in 680. His son, Vinayaditya, inherited his rule. Although hostility with the Pallava kingdom continued, Vinayaditya managed to avoid major confrontations during his 16-year reign. Chalukya power now stretched across the center of the subcontinent, covering the former patchwork. The Pallava, meanwhile, extended their power to the south. The island that lay off India's southeastern coast, Sri Lanka, had at various times been claimed by South Indian rulers, but more often than not, it played host to several different tiny independent kingdoms at a time. In 684, a warrior named Manavarma asked the Pallava to lend him the soldiers he needed to make himself king of the entire island. Manavarma succeeded, but as payment for the soldiers, he was forced to pay tribute to the Pallava. Like the Chalukya kings, the Pallava dynasty had pushed its rule over the surrounding lands, and farther, down past the water, into the southern island. Chapter 41. The Troubles of Empire. Between 643 and 661, the followers of Islam establish an empire and suffer from power struggles, assassination, and unrest. By 643, the armies of Islam under their commander Umar had conquered more territory in less time than any army since Alexander the Great's. But Umar's enormous gains ended in 644, when he was stabbed 6 times by a Persian captive slave as he led morning prayers in Medina. The slave killed himself directly afterwards. Umar died slowly over several days, which made it possible for him to arrange for a successor. Rather than electing one himself, he appointed a council of 6 Muslims from Mecca to pick the next caliph. Once again, the supporters of Muhammad's son-in-law, Ali, suggested that he be given the title. Once again, Ali was passed over. The council selected another of Muhammad's old companions, Uthman, who was, like them, Meccan, and who was, like them, of the Quraysh tribe. In the years since Muhammad's death, Ali had spent most of his time with non-Quraysh Muslims, and the council wanted to ensure that the Quraysh stayed in control. Tribal loyalties were not yet dead in the Ummah. As caliph, Uthman began the job of turning the extended conquests into something like a centralized empire. Umar had laid the foundation for an Arabic empire that, like Rome's, would draw a multiplicity of lands and languages under its banner. But the Arabic Empire had sprung up in a matter of years, not over the course of centuries, and there had been no careful assimilation, no granting of citizenship to outsiders who had craved it. There had barely even been time for the Arabs, under the banner of Islam, to commit themselves to the new idea of empire. Abu Bakr had provided a shaky cohesion by sending his new converts against the outside enemy. Umar, at the time of his death, had been putting into place an empire-wide hierarchy based on length of service, Saqiba, priority in Islam, giving the highest positions to those who had become Muslim the earliest. Had this continued, converts who persisted would have had the hope of rising to power. Faithfulness to Islam over a long period might have provided glue to bind the new conquests to the old, but Uthman was old school. He planned to keep the entire conquered realm under the tight control of the Quraysh clan, to turn it, in fact, into a fantastically distended mirror of Mecca. This required top-down control. He centered his government in Medina and appointed governors to supervise the outer reaches of the empire. He kept tight hold of the chief governors and military officials, appointing and removing them himself, and they were responsible only to him. Under his guidance, conquests continued. Arab armies had occupied Alexandria, Now they could use the Alexandrian navy to reinforce their own ground forces. They had gained a grand new power, the use of the sea. The desert hardiness that had allowed them to push through the Makran was matched by a complete ignorance of the water. Umar had been terrified of the sea, and had forbidden his armies to use it. "By him who sent Muhammad with the truth, I shall never send any Muslim upon it," he had written at the height of his power. The Arab governor of Syria, Muawiyah, had pleaded with him to change his mind, but he had refused. Uthman, on the other hand, granted Muawiyah permission to create a naval force, on condition that he use only volunteers for his sailors. But shaping a sea army from scratch was a slow process. The capture of the Alexandrian fleet catapulted the Arab ability to use the water forward by decades. Muawiyah, now admiral of the Arab navy, began to train his new force to sail across the Mediterranean towards even more distant targets. Meanwhile, the new Arab governor appointed to run Egypt ordered his men to sack Alexandria and raise its walls. They chose a new city, Fostat, modern Cairo, to be a new capital, a new power in Egypt, a new beginning. A ground force marched from Egypt westward, through the old Roman lands of Libya. They stopped short of Carthage, but the North African towns, both the Romanized ones nearer the coast and the native African ones farther inland, fell under Arab control. The conquered towns paid tribute to the conquerors in slaves. The Arabs called all the natives of northern Africa west of Egypt Berbers, a name the Africans did not use for themselves, and the Berber slaves became involuntary recruits to the army, which grew and grew. By 649, Muawiyah's navy was ready to sail. He launched a fleet of 1,700 ships and landed on the island of Cyprus, a short trip to the west. Cyprus, which was still in Byzantine hands, fell almost at once. The new sea force began to launch raids on Byzantine cities along the coast of Asia Minor. At the same time, a powerful ground force marched through Armenia into the Caucasus Mountains, in a bid to move around the Black Sea and take Constantinople from the north. Constantinople remained the jewel at the end of the quest. Even the North African conquests were ultimately intended to bring the Arab armies to the walls of New Rome. "Only through Spain can Constantinople be conquered," Uthman had told his commanders. But the attempt to circle the Black Sea failed. The Khazars fought back and prevented the Arab armies from passing through. During all this time, the Persian king Yazdegerd III had been on the run, moving farther east with Arab soldiers behind him and still claiming to rule what remained of Persia. Throughout the 640s, he seems to have been in Fars, leading a tiny, persistent resistance movement. Towards the end of the decade, Uthman spared a detachment to go in and put the resistance movement down. The soldiers chased Yazdegerd north into the province of Kirman, but the Arab army was caught in a blizzard and froze. "The snow reached the height of a lance," Al-Tabari says. Only the commander, one soldier, and a slave girl survived, the latter because her owner slit open the stomach of a camel and packed her inside it to keep her warm. Yazdegerd apparently intended to keep up his resistance, but he hadn't reckoned with the change economics of his country. Putting a little more distance between himself and the Arab border, he went down into Sistan, where he ordered the governor to pay the taxes which had not been collected over the past year. The governor indignantly refused, so Yazdegerd travelled north into Khorasan, the last place where he might be able to mount that defence and demanded shelter for the winter. But he was still hauling along with him the remnants of his royal court, 4,000 or so secretaries, displaced officials, palace staff, and their women and children. There was no way to support that many idle people during winter in the mountains, in a province cut off from its former trade partners. Instead of turning the king away, the Khorasan governor hired a couple of assassins to solve the problem. The hired killers arrived in the middle of the night and did away with Yazdegerd's bodyguard. The king himself fled eastward and took shelter with a stone cutter on the banks of the Murghab River. As he slept, exhausted, the stone cutter murdered him and threw his body into the water. He had outlived his state and died trying to assert his authority over the corpse. With him, the entire medieval Persian state perished. The Persian Empire was no more. Uthman's attempts to turn his own conquered realm into a state now took a downturn. The first 6 years of his tenure as caliph, the years from 644 to 650, which were spent in conquest, had gone well, but in the last 6 years were increasingly difficult. The Arab historians who chronicle his rule say that the turn in his fortunes came when he lost the signet ring of the Prophet. It was made of silver, with Muhammad, the Messenger of God, engraved on it. Muhammad had used it to seal his correspondence with non-Arabs. It was passed, according to Al-Tabari, from Muhammad to Abu Bakr to Umar to Uthman. Uthman was sitting on the edge of a well in Medina when he began fiddling with the ring and twisting it around his finger. The ring slipped off and fell into the well. They searched for it and even drained the well of its water, but without success. When he despaired of finding the signet ring, he ordered another one like it in form and appearance, and made of silver, to be fashioned for him. On it was engraved, "Muhammad, the Messenger of God." Then Uthman placed it on his finger until he perished. The story suggests not only that Uthman's legitimacy as the proper successor of the Prophet was called into question, but also that it was ultimately shown to be an illusion. The difficulties were multiple. He had been unable to halt the continual rebellions of the conquered cities in Persia, and the desert-trained Arab armies did not fight well in the mountains of the provinces. There, the Persian aristocracy continued to survive, and Persian religion, language, and practice were carried out almost without interference. To the west, the conquests had not formed any sort of coherent empire. Rather, Arab power existed in separated, highly reinforced areas along the North African coast, and communication between those enclaves required that Arab troops keep on conquering and reconquering the connecting areas. Uthman had made some steps towards developing an identity for his empire not based solely on swords. He had begun the project of assembling a definitive version of all Muhammad's teachings. The Prophet did not write. His revelations, or surahs, were conveyed orally and recorded by his followers, sometimes in several different forms. With the expansion of the empire, Muslims, widely separated in geography, were beginning to compile their own collections. There were differences among these local anthologies, and Uthman knew that without a unified sacred book, the extension of the empire had the potential to destroy the Islamic identity of those within it. But this was a strategy that took time and a certain amount of peace to accomplish. Even once a definitive Quran was assembled, it had to be copied and then taken to the outskirts of the empire, and half of the time those were inaccessible because of war. Discontent with Uthman's rule grew. Revolt in the outlying conquered areas broke out on a regular basis. Uthman sent his governors the message that they should maintain stringent control of those under their authority, and keep the people tied up on campaigns in order to keep them out of trouble. This made things even worse. Strong authority would not have been resented in Byzantium or Persia, or even the kingdoms of the Franks, but Uthman was supposed to be one Muslim among brothers. He was not supposed to be a king. By 654, Al-Tabari says, Uthman's enemies were writing to each other, planning to meet together and confront him with his inadequacies. Actual revolt began in the city of Kufa, on the western bank of the Euphrates. It had been founded by Arabs as military headquarters for the conquest of Persia, and had since grown into a large and bustling Muslim city. Its Arab population had emigrated to the city from all over Arabia, but under Uthman's policies, only Quraysh were promoted into positions of power, and Uthman showed a particular preference for members of his own clan, the Banu Umayya. Resentment deepened when Uthman ordered the city to send all of its surplus revenue to Medina for use by the Arabs there. At this point, Ali ibn Abu Talib, son-in-law of Muhammad, reappeared on the scene, commissioned by a group of discontent Muslims to speak to Uthman on their behalf. He, like Uthman, was in Medina, the seat of the highly centralized government that Uthman relied on. The point of conflict was the appointment of one Aban Amir, a relative of Uthman, but a man unpopular with many, to a high position in the city government in Kufa. "If I have favoured kinsmen," snapped Uthman, "what have I done wrong?" Ali answered, "You have been weak and easygoing with your relatives." "They are your relatives as well," Uthman said, and Ali retorted, "They are closely related to me, but merit is found in others." Ali remained the spokesman for the disenfranchised. The year after, in 655, the people of Kufa deposed the unpopular governor. Arab rebels from Kufa marched on Medina and besieged Uthman in his house. They were joined by men from Medina who were bitter over Uthman's partiality to his own Banu Umayya clan. Uthman appealed to Ali ibn Abu Talib to intercede with the people on his behalf. Ali, after talking with Uthman, agreed to tell the people that in 3 days, Uthman would meet all of their complaints by doing justice, whether it be against himself or anyone else, and that he will abandon everything that you detest. He wrote out a document that gave Uthman a 3-day grace period to do away with every injustice and remove every governor whom they disliked. Ali had the document witnessed by a body of the leading emigrants and helpers. Thus, the people turned back and withdrew until he should fulfill the promises that he had freely given them. But Uthman began preparing for war and gathering arms. When the 3 days had passed, and he had done nothing to alter anything which was hateful to the people or to remove any governor, they revolted against him. Uthman's enemy surrounded his house, intending to kill him. He had ruled not as a prophet of God, but as commander of the faithful, and although he claimed divine sanction for his authority, the support of the faithful was his ultimate legitimization. He had lost it. Standing on the walls of his house, he warned his assassins, "If you kill me, you will never pray together again, nor will God ever remove dissension from among you." They answered, "You were worthy of authority, but since then you have changed." Then they broke into his house and stabbed him to death with iron-headed arrows, grasped like spears in their hands. Rather than being buried at once, as Muslim custom dictated, Uthman's body was thrown into a courtyard and left for 3 days. His family had to appeal to Ali, who had become the de facto leader of the city, to get permission to take the body. He was buried in a Jewish cemetery. No Muslim cemetery would allow him to be interred. Not long after, a gathering of Ali's supporters, rebels and many of the Quraysh who were not from the Banu Umayyah clan, declared him to be the next caliph. He must have seen this coming. Nevertheless, he hesitated. Another voice was protesting, and it was a strong one, the voice of Aisha, widow of the Prophet and daughter of the first caliph, Abu Bakr. She insisted that Ali had no right to rule, that the leadership of the Muslim community, widely dispersed as it was, should stay within the clan of the Umayyad, with its blood tie to Muhammad himself. Ali found himself in an odd position. He did not particularly want to come up against the wife of the Prophet in conflict. On the other hand, her argument was a difficult one. The Banu Umayyah clan was related to Muhammad, but distantly. The Banu Umayyah and the Banu Hashim, Muhammad's actual clan, had a common ancestor. Ali, by contrast, was Banu Hashim. He was not only Muhammad's son-in-law, but also his cousin. And his son Hassan was the grandson of the Prophet, child of Muhammad's daughter Fatima. Yet it was already known that Ali did not intend for the Quraysh tribe, to which both clans belonged, to continue to hold all the power for itself. In arguing that Uthman's clan, rather than Muhammad's own, become the royal family of the Islamic Empire, Aisha was working to keep the tribe in power. Ultimately, Ali decided to accept the title of caliph. Later, he wrote to the Muslim governor of Egypt about his decision. It could not even be imagined that the Arabs would snatch the seat of the caliphate from the family and descendants of the Holy Prophet, and that they would be swearing the oath of allegiance for the caliphate to a different person. At every stage, I kept myself aloof from that struggle of supremacy and power politics, till I found the heretics had openly taken to heresy and schism, and were trying to undermine and ruin the religion preached by our Holy Prophet. He believed that establishing the caliphate in the Banu Umayyah clan would make it unambiguously into a political position, destroying its close connection to Muhammad and his mission. Yet to prevent this from happening, he would be forced to fight. Aisha and her supporters had already left Medina, heading for the city of Basra at the head of the Persian Gulf, where they hoped to gather more supporters for their cause. Ali gathered soldiers and followed them. In December of 656, 6 months after he had accepted the title, he met his enemies outside Basra's walls in the Battle of the Camel. More Arabs had come down from Kufa to support him, and he won a quick victory. Aisha's supporters were killed, and she was forced to return to private life. But this first fight over the caliphate began a civil war, the fitna, the trials. Ali moved the seat of his caliphate from Medina to Kufa. Kufa was much more central to the newly conquered empire and was solidly behind him. He sent new governors, friendly to his cause, to take over the administration of the rebellious provinces, but one of the old governors refused. Muawiyah, founder of the navy, was still serving as governor of Syria, and Uthman had been his cousin. Instead of relinquishing his post, he threatened to fight back unless Uthman's murderers were put to death. Although Ali had not been directly involved in the bloodshed, the culprits were some of his strongest supporters. Executing them was not an option. He wrote back to Muawiyah in defiance, accusing him of seeking justice and even adopting Islam for personal gain. "When you saw that all the big people of Arabia had embraced Islam and had gathered under the banner of the Holy Prophet, you also walked in. By Allah, I know you too well to argue with you or to advise you. Apostasy and avariciousness have taken a firm hold of your mind. Your intelligence is of an inferior order, and you cannot differentiate what in the end is good for you and what is not. You have also written so much about the murderers of Caliph Uthman. The correct thing for you to do is to take the oath of allegiance to me, as others have done, and present the case in my court of justice, and then I shall pass my judgment according to the tenets of the Holy Quran." Muawiyah had no intention of taking any oath. The two men traded increasingly testy messages. "I received your letter," Ali wrote, "and to me it appears to be an idiotic confusion of irrelevant ideas," until it became clear that only armed confrontation would sort out their difficulties. They met in July of 657 on the Upper Euphrates, each at the head of an army. Neither commander seems to have been comfortable with the idea of battle between two groups of Muslims. "Do not take the initiative in fighting," Ali told his men. "Let them begin it, and do not attack those who have surrendered." When the battle did begin, the fighting dragged on inconclusively for 3 days. Finally, Muawiyah's men pulled back, impaled leaves of the Quran on the tips of their spears, and insisted that the two leaders work out their differences according to the laws of Islam. Ali's soldiers joined in the demand, and the rivals gave in to the inevitable. Negotiations, carried on through various intermediaries, were long, drawn out, and unsatisfactory for both sides. Eventually, Ali ended up with the title of Caliph, ruling from Kufa. Muawiyah remained in Syria, without a title but ruling independently. Practically, the empire had been divided. Its existence under one caliphate was a convenient myth. Ali's tenure as caliph remained troubled. The undercurrent of guilt over Uthman's murder continued to run through his camp. In 658, a segment of his army broke away, accusing Ali of injustice because he had not avenged Uthman's death. Injustice invalidated his charter. The unrighted wrong meant that he could not rule as true caliph. Ali first tried to arbitrate with these rebels, whom his other troops called Kharijis, seceders. Then he attacked them. He was unable to get rid of them, and the soldiers who were still loyal to him had little stomach for continually warring against their own kin. His power was dwindling. In 661, a Kharijī assassin murdered Ali in his camp. His remaining supporters tried to arrange the election of his son Hassan, the Prophet's grandson, as caliph, but far more Arabs were arrayed behind Muawiyah. Hassan, a mature man in his 40s who was not suicidal, agreed to come to a settlement with Muawiyah and his 60,000 soldiers. He would retire peacefully to Medina as a private person. In return, Muawiyah promised that the caliphate would pass back to Hassan should Muawiyah die before him. The fitna had ended, and the Banu Umayyah had risen to power. Muawiyah, the fifth caliph after the Prophet, was Umayyad, but like his predecessor, he was forced to fight constantly against rebels who resented his power. The Islamic Empire, which had once been centered around the community of the faithful, was beginning to look more and more like any other medieval empire, a conquered mass of peoples, some in constant rebellion, with ongoing struggles for power at the top and an ever-present tendency for the whole thing to fly apart. In turning those first Arab warriors outward, Abu Bakr had preserved the unity of the Ummah, but victory and conquest were already tearing at it from the inside. Part 4. States and Kingdoms. Chapter 42. Law and Language. Between 643 and 702, the emperor tries to leave Constantinople. The Lombards and the Bulgarians move towards nationhood, and North Africa falls to the armies of Islam. The Lombards of Italy suffered no inconveniences from the Arab invasions to the east. In fact, the Eastern Wars made it possible for the Lombard king, Rothari, elected in 636, to throw off almost all remaining tendrils of Byzantine control. While the emperor was occupied fighting with the armies of Islam, Rothari busied himself with systematically wiping out the emperor's claim on all Italian lands, except for the enclave at Ravenna and the walled city of Rome itself. These gains meant that it was time for the Lombards to mature away from their beginnings as conquering invaders toward existence as a nation. The Lombards were partly worshippers of the old Germanic gods, partly Arian Christians, partly Catholic Christians. A shared religion could have provided them with cohesion, but Rothari, a man of vision, wanted to give them more than cohesion. He wanted to give them statehood, so in 643 he created a written law, something they had never had. "This king Rothari," writes Paul the Deacon, "collected in a series of writings the laws of the Langobards, Lombards, which they were keeping in memory only and custom, and he directed this code to be called the Edict." The Edict of Rothari, or 388 chapters of it, was written in Latin, but the laws were Lombard, Germanic spirit inhabiting Roman flesh. Pulling a man's beard, an insult among Germanic warriors, drew a steep fine. Those who deserted a comrade in battle were sentenced to death. A man who wished to transfer property to another had to do so in the presence of the Thing, the assembly of freemen. The laws helped to establish the borders of the Lombard kingdom, which to this point had been a rather amorphous thing. "All Werragang who come from outside our frontiers into the boundaries of our kingdom," Rothari decreed, referring to foreign warriors settling in Lombard land, "ought to live according to the Lombard laws." The Lombard lands in Italy were becoming Lombardy, a country for the wandering Lombards to call home. As part of its tradition into statehood, Lombardy was leaning towards Orthodox Catholicism. The Arian Christianity of its leaders had been a marker of their Germanic blood, a leftover of the days when they were outsiders both to orthodoxy and to political power. Rothari's successor, Aripert, became the first Catholic king of Lombardy, moving the Italian kingdom closer to the political mainstream. In 661, when Aripert died, a brief war erupted between his sons. It ended with one son dead, the other in flight, and the crown in the hands of Duke Grimoald of Benevento, one of the semi-independent Lombard chiefs who was supposed to be loyal to the Lombard king. All the way over in Constantinople, Constans II decided to intervene. Constans, 14 when he came to the throne, had watched Egypt and North Africa fall to the Arabs at the same time that Italy was breaking away. Now, in 661, he was 30 years old, father of three sons, and nicknamed Constans the Bearded, because of his remarkably heavy beard. He had assumed control of the empire, and the civil war in Lombardy gave him a plan. The Arab assault may have seemed unstoppable, but Italy was vulnerable. Constans II decided to leave Constantinople, set up his campaign headquarters in Tarentum, on the instep of the Italian boot, and reconquer the peninsula. Constans II was not popular in Constantinople, which no doubt made the idea of re-establishing the throne in Rome even more attractive. But the plan reveals the extent to which the Byzantines still thought of themselves as Roman. Few of them had ever been to the Eternal City. No emperor had visited Rome in generations. Italy itself had long been out of Byzantine hands. Yet somehow Rome still occupied a place in the imagination. Constans II, heading for Rome, was out to recapture the glorious past. By 663, Constans II was established in Tarentum and carrying on a reasonably successful war against the Lombard holdings in the south. A number of southern cities surrendered to him, and soon he was approaching the walls of Benevento, Grimoald's hometown. King Grimoald, now at the Lombard capital Pavia, far to the north, had left one of his sons in charge of the city. The son sent to him for help, and Grimoald began the journey south with his royal army. It must have been a large army, because Constans II was greatly alarmed at the news of Grimoald's approach. He retreated, first to the coastal city of Naples, which had agreed to receive him. It had been loyal to Constantinople since Belisarius had taken it away from the Ostrogoths in 536, and then to Rome, the first visit of an emperor to the old city since Romulus Augustus had been dethroned. He stayed in Rome only 12 days, attended divine services conducted by the Pope, raided the city for any remaining gold or copper ornaments he could melt down and use to fund his war, and then departed for Sicily. He landed on the island, went to Syracuse, and declared it to be his new capital. His intention to reclaim Rome hadn't survived his first sight of the city. He had been imagining glories, but the real city, shabby, depopulated, demoralized, seemed beyond repair. From Syracuse, he again began to launch attacks on the south of Italy. He ruled the island like an emperor of old, despotic, demanding, and imperious. He also sent for his wife and sons, a clear indication that he intended to stay in the west, away from Constantinople. Thanks to his efforts, Byzantium kept control of the southern Italian coast, but his tyrannical behavior made him unpopular, his apparent desertion of New Rome even more so. In 668, one of his house servants, undoubtedly part of a larger conspiracy, battered him on the head with a soapbox until he died. His son Constantine IV was acclaimed in Constantinople and, profiting from his father's poor example, remained there. In 670, 2 years after Constantine IV's accession, the Arab advance along the North African coast began again. At the same time, the Arab spread continued to the east. In the mountains north of India, Arab armies drove the king of the Shahi out of Kabul, his capital. The Shahi kingdom kept control of the Khyber Pass, but was forced to move its capital city east to Uddabhandapura. The multi-pronged expansion reached Constantinople in 674, when Arab armies laid siege to the city itself. The siege lasted 4 years, but Constantinople was able to continually refresh its supplies by sea, and conditions never became desperate. The Arab navy launched a final sea attack in 678, but the Byzantine ships made use of their famous Greek fire, a chemical concoction launched through tubes that kept burning even when it met the water. And finally the Arab ships withdrew, followed shortly after by the land forces. While the emperor and his men were occupied with the defense of Constantinople, the Bulgarian tribes were given the space and time to expand. 30 years earlier, the emperor Heraclius had recognized the kingship of the Bulgarian chief Kubrat, north of the Azov Sea. Kubrat had died in 669, after a long reign during which he pushed the boundaries of old Great Bulgaria up to the Donets and down to the Danube. Like a Frankish chief, he left the kingdom to his 5 sons jointly. In his history, the Chronographicon Syntomon, the 9th-century patriarch Nicephorus, says that while on his deathbed, Kubrat brought his sons around him and challenged each to break a bundle of sticks with his bare hands. When they all failed, he undid the bundle and broke the sticks easily, one by one. "Stay united," he told them, "for a bundle is not easily broken." Instead, the 5 sons split apart almost at once. The 2nd son, Kotrag, went north to the Volga and settled with his followers, where they became known as the Silver Bulgars. The 3rd son, Asporuk, settled between the Dniester and the Prut River, with over 30,000 followers of his own. The 4th, Kuber, led a little band of Bulgarians first into Pannonia and then back toward Macedonia. The 5th son, Alsek, took his crowd all the way to Italy, and formed a little Bulgarian enclave there. The oldest son, Bayan, remained in his homeland, ruling over the diminished population that remained once his brothers had left. The wisdom of Kubrat's warning became clear. Almost at once, the Khazars attacked Bayan, reduced his kingdom to rubble, and swallowed his territory, bringing an end to the original old great Bulgarian kingdom. Constantine IV tried to emulate the Khazar Khan. In 679, once he had recovered somewhat from the siege of Constantinople, he marched against Asparuk's 30,000 Bulgarians, who lay just on Byzantium's western border. He was at first successful, but Theophanes says that he was forced to withdraw from the lines because he was suffering from gout, and that his troops became disheartened and fled. The Bulgarian war leader Asparuk then made an alliance with the Slavic tribes nearby, fought his way down into Thracia, and generally caused a headache for the Byzantine armies on the northwestern border. By 681, Constantine IV had decided that he'd better make peace. He swore out a treaty with Asparuk, even agreeing to pay the Bulgars yearly tribute. The Byzantine tribute payments and the conquests gave Asparuk more than a temporary settlement. His group of refugees, funded by Constantinople's tribute payments, became the first Bulgarian empire. The peace with the First Bulgarian Empire was followed, somewhat unexpectedly, by peace with the Arabs. Muawiyah, the 5th caliph after the Prophet, died late in 680. He was followed by a string of short-lived caliphs. 4 within 5 years. Finally, in 685, a caliph with the ability to both direct campaigns and administer the increasingly chaotic empire came to the throne, Abd al-Malik ibn Marwan, who began his rule by ruthlessly squelching the Arabs who supported other candidates to the caliphate. It would take him 6 years to wipe out the opposition, 6 years of spending more energy fighting other Arabs rather than the rest of the world, at a time when he was also dealing with famine and an outbreak of sickness, possibly a minor visitation of the plague in Syria. He sent to Constantine IV, offering to pay tribute in order to confirm a peace, and Constantine IV agreed to the terms. Shortly afterwards, Constantine IV died and left the throne of Constantinople to his son, Justinian II. Justinian II, only 16, inherited an empire that had slowly been reorganized over the previous decades into more efficient, more easily defensible divisions. Rather than the unwieldy provinces of the earlier empire, Byzantium was now divided into themes. Instead of being defended by troops dispatched from the capital under the command of officers unfamiliar with their assigned territories, themes were defended by native soldiers. Since Heraclius, the emperors had slowly been awarding land in the themes to soldiers in return for lifelong military service, and the tax system had been gradually reorganized so that the citizens in each theme paid their taxes directly to the local troops rather than sending the money to the capital, where it might or might not get back to where it was meant to be. The armies in each theme thus had strong motivation to protect it. Local loyalties, which always had the potential to rip an empire apart, had been directed into defending it. There were 4 themes in Asia Minor, another in Thracia, and 2 more in Greece and Sicily. Justinian II also inherited the peace treaty with Abd al-Malik, which he agreed to renew. This gave Justinian time to get his bearings as emperor, while Abd al-Malik was able to finish putting down the rebellions against his caliphate. By 692, he had mastered his enemies and was, without competition, the only caliph of the Muslims. Both men now wanted to break the treaty. Al-Malik was ready to go back to conquering, and Justinian wanted to prove his worth as emperor. In late 692, Al-Malik provided a useful excuse for both of them when he paid his tribute with Arab coins rather than Byzantine currency. He had been working for some time to stabilize the financial affairs in the Islamic Empire by creating a standard Arabic coinage. Justinian II at once announced the coins counterfeit and unacceptable, and declared war. He had hired, to reinforce his own army, 30,000 or so Bulgarian troops as mercenaries. He levied 30,000 men, armed them, and named them the Special Army, Theophanes writes. He was confident in them, certain he could meet Al-Malik in battle with success. He was wrong. The Arab forces pushed into Byzantine land. When the armies met in 694 at the Battle of Sebastopolis on the southern shore of the Black Sea, the Bulgarians cut and ran. Al-Malik had sent money behind the scenes and promised them more if they would retreat once the battle began. The Byzantine troops were unable to hold the front without their allies and retreated. Al-Malik, flushed with victory, began a series of raids on the Byzantine coast. Justinian II, still only 24, took vengeance on the traitorous Bulgarians by massacring their wives and children, but his army was inclined to blame him, not the mercenaries. In 695, the officers rebelled against him, took him captive, and mutilated him by cutting off his nose, slitting his tongue, and sending him in chains to Cherson, the fortress where military prisoners languished. They acclaimed one of their own generals, Leontios, as emperor in his place. With Leontios at the helm, the empire suffered the final loss of Carthage, its complete occupation by Arab forces, and the end of 800 years of Roman settlement in North Africa. The caliph al-Malik appointed an Arabic governor named Musa bin Nusayr to rule the new Muslim province, Ifriqiya, and back in Constantinople, the general Leontios suffered the wages of defeat and was in turn overthrown. In 698, he was taken prisoner, mutilated, and sent to a monastery, and the army chose another soldier as emperor. By 702, the Islamic conquest of North Africa was nearly complete. The Berbers, the native North Africans, converted in remarkable numbers. Their tribal structure made conversion a mass event rather than an individual decision. When the leaders of a tribe converted, the rest of the tribe followed. The Arabic realm itself was beginning to cohere a little more tightly under al-Malik's expert administration. He had already introduced standard currency. He put his brothers, whom he trusted, into the most vital governor's offices, and he began to construct a new mosque in Jerusalem that would provide a place of worship and pilgrimage, even more central than the Kaaba in Mecca, although Mecca retained its importance. This mosque, the Dome of the Rock, was built on the site of the destroyed Second Temple of the Jews. It protected the rock from which Muhammad was said to have ascended into heaven. Author's note: the Second Temple was built in the 6th century BC to replace Solomon's Temple, which had been destroyed by the Babylonians. Al-Malik also decreed that the Arabic language would be the official language of the empire, something no previous caliph had done. This proved a desperately needed glue for the widely scattered realm. Islam and the Arabic language were the two constants throughout the lands of the Arab conquests. Christianity and Latin had parted ways somewhat, as the Franks and Visigoths and Lombards and Greeks translated the texts of their religion into their own tongue, but Islam and Arabic, and Islam and Arabic culture, would remain tied closely together. Chapter 43. Creating the Past. Between 661 and 714, the heavenly sovereigns of Japan decree a great reform, issue a code of law, and write a legendary history. The tidal wash and ebb of attacking and retreating armies shaped the internal politics of almost every medieval nation but Japan. On their jagged islands, protected on the west by sea and on the east by a vast expanse of ocean, the heavenly sovereigns ruled. The borders of their power nebulous, making little attempt to conquer themselves an empire by force, their attention fixed firmly on home ground. But although Tang warships did not dock at the harbor of the Yamato rulers, the Tang were nevertheless invading by a slow and insidious infiltration of ideas. After her second spell on the throne, the heavenly sovereign Sai Mei died in 661, leaving the Yamato crown to her son. Naka no Owe finally stood at the top of the pyramid of power, with his longtime ally Nakatomi no Kamatari as his right-hand man. But for nearly 7 years after his mother's death, Naka no Owe continued to govern as crown prince and regent. Not until 668 did he finally claim the rightful title of heavenly sovereign and the imperial name Tenji. He was 42 years old. He had spent 23 years waiting for the stain of Soga blood to fade from his hands before reaching for the scepter. Not long after his formal accession, he rewarded Nakatomi no Kamatari's lifelong loyalty by giving him a new name, Fujiwara. By this act, he made his friend the patriarch of a new clan, founder of a new family. The Fujiwara clan would rise steadily in power, eventually reaching a height of influence greater than that of the broken-backed Soga. Tenji's disastrous plunge into foreign politics, his attempt to help Baekje's king regain the throne, had ended with a shattering defeat of the Japanese army by the Tang-Silla alliance, had merely reinforced the natural Yamato tendency to focus on the home front. As crown prince, and with the help of Nakatomi no Kamatari, he had already written and tried to put into place a whole series of reforms intended to transform the Yamato domain, still a linked series of clans, dominated by clan leaders who jealously guarded their own authority, into a single royal realm, governed without dispute by a single monarch. The new sweeping decrees were called the Great Reform, or the Taika Reforms. By legal fiat, all of the Yamato domain was declared to be a single public realm, held by the crown on behalf of the people. Private estates and hereditary clan rights over them were abolished. So was the old system of titles. "Let the following be abolished," the first reform edict declared: private titles to lands and workers held by ministers and functionaries of the court, by local nobles, and by village chiefs. Instead of owning their land and claiming the titles of nobility, the former clan leaders and village chiefs would be granted the right to govern the land, which now essentially belonged to the Yamato ruler. And instead of claiming their noble titles, they would be awarded ranks that positioned them in a newly formed bureaucracy. The Great Reform was not invented by the Yamato. It came over the water from China. Naka no Owe had sent scores of scholars and priests over to the Tang to learn the long history of the Chinese emperorship, to study the structures of Tang government, and to bring back what they learned. The world that the Great Reform attempted to create is modeled after the ancient Chinese map of the world, a set of concentric rings with the Emperor's power all-encompassing at the center, and executed by proxy at the distant edges. In places, the edicts of the Great Reform quote, word for word, from the Chinese histories that Naka no Oe's emissaries brought back from their travels. The centuries of disorder in Luoyang and Nanjing made little difference. The Chinese emperors could claim, fairly or not, to belong to a tradition of royal authority that flowed down from the beginnings of time, and the Yamato aspired to join the ancient stream. As heavenly sovereign, Tenji, the former Naka no Oe, now set himself to create a court in which he would stand, like the emperors of China, not merely as war leader and chief general, a position vulnerable to the fortunes of war, but as representative of an entire culture, leader of civilization, guarantor of cosmic order. Historian Joan Piggott, borrowing the term from Confucius, calls this pole star monarchy. The sovereign, says the Analects, exercises government by means of his virtue and thus may be compared to the North Polar Star, which keeps its place and all the stars turn towards it. In his effort to become the orienting point of Japanese culture, Heavenly Sovereign Tenji brought historians and poets to his court and founded a university. He and his court read the Chinese classics, which had arrived in the hands of a traveling Buddhist monk in 660. He led his court in celebrating Chinese rites that linked heavenly order to earthly tranquility. According to his biographers, Heavenly Sovereign Tenji also ordered his ministers to collect the laws of Japan into a written legal code, distinct from the Great Reforms. Japan, filled with discrete communities, with a heavenly sovereign whose rule was largely theoretical rather than hands-on in many of its parts, had existed without a legal code for a long time. But partly due to the contact with Tang China and United Silla, partly due to Tenji's sense that a heavenly sovereign should have a little more power on earth, it was time for written laws. This code does not seem to have ever been completed. Whatever work was done on it stalled when Heavenly Sovereign Tenji became ill after a mere 4 years of official rule. The illness caused him severe, unrelieved pain in his last days and hours. Finally, the atonement for Soga no Iruka